Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
Good job, us.
Look at us. Welcome to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
Do you want me to just start talking?
Yeah, that's what we do here.
Okay, so this guest today is someone that I have been wanting to have on for over a year. As soon as I met him at the I Will Survive Women's Weekend here in South Carolina, I immediately knew that he was someone who could bring so much good content to our podcast and our followers and all of our listeners. So I wanted to have him on. It's just taken a little while to get all of our ducks in a row. But today's guest is James Hamilton.
He's like a survivor dad. Best dad protective energy. I love this conversation.
Like, when you hear his bio, you're going to think that he's like, go hard, heavy kind of guy. But he's just so gentle and also hard when it needs to be. He's like just the best dad energy. And I love him so much. Literally sent Kim a text message during this interview and was like, do you love him? And she's like, yes. And I was like, me too.
All the caps, all the emojis. So James Hamilton is a nationally recognized personal security expert and former FBI supervisory special agent. For more than 30 years, he's been a protector, trainer, and advisor to the nation's most at-risk individuals.
He has real, practical, and unparalleled experience in violence prevention and personal security. This real experience was earned through service in local law enforcement, the FBI, and America's premier executive protection firm, which you'll hear him talk more about.
Mm-hmm. He's protected government officials, high net worth individuals, and leading religious figures all over the globe, like really all over the globe, and has empowered thousands of individuals to stay safe in an increasingly dangerous world.
James has dedicated his entire career to this particular area of expertise and is sought after by those seeking practical and sound security guidance. He just has so much real world experience, advice, and so many moments that I know you guys are going to hear and you're going to write them down. You're going to want to just like stamp these things in your soul. And I'm so excited for you guys to hear this conversation.
So here is our interview with James Hamilton.
All right. This is such a good episode that I've really been looking forward to ever since I met James last year at the I Will Survive weekend here in South Carolina. I heard him talk and I thought that this would be a perfect interview to bring to you guys because I think it's genuinely going to change lives. So welcome to the podcast, James.
Thank you for having me. That's quite an introduction. Hope I can live up to it.
Yeah, no pressure. It's fine.
No.
We always start off with an icebreaker here, and it is, what is your current binge? Whether that is a TV show, book series, podcast, whatever it might be, what's your current binge?
There's a Netflix series about Formula One racing called Drive to Survive, maybe. No, that's not right. Drive to something. If you just put Formula One Netflix. Yeah, as a child, I think I always wanted to be a race car driver, like most young men, I think. I don't know. I just was always drawn to Formula One, and I can't get enough of this. I'm binging the heck out of it. So, yeah.
Yes. I grew up, Sundays were for worshiping the left turn. My dad watched. Yeah, I didn't understand football until I probably got to college, but yeah, it was definitely NASCAR. We are a Dale Earnhardt family, but I love seeing all the new Formula One stuff really hitting mainstream.
Oh, it's unbelievable. What those drivers do is, it's hard to even comprehend.
It's a sport.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to train for it. I think that's one of the things that is undervalued with something like that. You're like, oh, they just get in a car and drive. It's like 4 hours.
Yeah. Left, right, and change gears. I heard for the first time they have in their contract, if another driver can get within 3/10 of a second or something of their time, they lose their seat. So that's pretty intense. Ooh. When you think about it. There's only 20 seats available. That's an incredible amount of competition. So, yeah.
My God, that sounds so stressful. Like you could lose your job at any time.
Imagine that in any other realm, meteorology. I'm sorry, you're off by how much of an inch of snowfall has done. You're out.
Yeah. And these guys all retire like 28. You know, it's like 28. Man, I didn't know who I was at 28.
Right? We took our kids to a NASCAR race last year. Like, it was kind of us getting back into it because Kim, I grew up watching it, but haven't really done that as an adult. And so we went and I was looking at the little handout, the pamphlet thing, whatever, with all of the driver stats. And there's like a 20-year-old driver. I'm like, What was I doing at 20? Like, I had no idea who and what I was. And this guy's like a freaking NASCAR driver. I'm like, that's an infant. That is an infant driving a car.
That's
dangerous.
That's right.
So that's awesome. That's fun. So now that we've broken the ice, tell us a little bit about you, who you are, how you got to be where you are today, to your comfort level, whatever you want to share with us.
Oh, yeah, man. 32 years I've been doing security protection, and I'll talk about what that is exactly in a second. But I think all of that really started, you know, at childhood, coming from a, you know, just an environment that kind of led me toward protection. My parents were divorced, and so that was tough to deal with. But, you know, other things happened, like many people, I think, in my space. You just had some things that you saw that you kind of had a hard time with, and you wanted to protect people. So I was always drawn to kind of that role of protecting someone. I had no idea really about protection or the FBI. Like I said, I really thought it'd be like a race car driver or some craziness, like really crazy. Fighter pilot, a military, I don't know. Went to military school because my dad did. I mean, that's just a fact. My dad went to the Citadel, so I went to the Citadel. There's a neat story on that. They were divorced, but you know, I always wanted to kind of get his approval, and he never really pressured me at all about it ever. It's a military school for those that don't know anything about it. Anyway, when I was a senior in high school, he said, what are you thinking about for college? And I was really thinking about going to the Marine Corps, just enlisting, not going to college. And I said, well, if I wasn't going to college, I'd probably go to the Citadel. He said, no, hell no. You can't hack that. That's too tough for you. And, you know, that was it. Like, that was just, he knew by saying that. I only applied to one place. That was it. I got in and, you know, I loved it. I'm kind of interesting in that respect. Everyone hated it, but then are glad they went there. But like, I loved it. Like I hated leaving. I didn't want to leave. I cried like a child when I left, when I graduated, because I just loved it. It was the greatest place in the world to me. So I was a criminal justice, like political science major, started thinking about the FBI. Why? Because of that Point Break movie. Because I saw that freaking Point Break movie.
I loved it.
Right? And I wanted to be Johnny Utah. And so I went and talked to the FBI guys in Charleston, and they said, well, we don't hire anyone out of college. You got to go be a lawyer, an accountant, or go be a police officer. Well, there was no way in hell I was going to go to law school. And so I had done an internship through the Citadel with the Charleston Police Department, and I loved it. I thought that was pretty cool. So I applied with the Richland County Sheriff's Office in Columbia, and I got picked up there. So I graduated and became a deputy and really, really enjoyed it. But one thing about that real quick that really set my trajectory was about 4 months into that, a guy I knew, friend of mine, I mean, acquaintance, he was killed in the line of duty, and he was killed by his partner. And so I learned very, very quickly, as if I didn't already understand it, but I learned very quickly that just giving a guy a gun doesn't mean they're competent. It doesn't make the environment safer. In fact, it can make the environment less safe. So he was killed by his partner, tragic situation on a domestic, but it stuck with me, right? So I don't know if you've ever been to a police funeral, but they stay with you. And it really set my trajectory. That led me into, well, I left with the FBI. FBI was really interesting. I enjoyed it. I realized very quickly that it wasn't like law enforcement, like being a police officer. And I gravitated to one very specific area, which was tactics and protection. So that's kind of weird because it comes back to when I was a kid, I wanted to do protection. I started in SWAT, was a SWAT operator, and then I applied for the FBI's director's detail, was selected for that, protected that gentleman all over the world for 4 years, and then promoted up to a supervisor. I went to Hogan's Alley as a tactical instructor, teaching new agents how to not get dead. And that was interesting because I was teaching new agents how to not shoot their partner, right? So like, go back to that's mm-hmm. like what happened to me, right? So like, you're literally like, okay, I'm going to do what I can to make sure like that doesn't happen. So I was doing that for a while. And then I started to run the FBI's overseas survival program, which was all about deploying overseas without a gun. So I loved it because I always believed that, you know, what I have in my hand is a tool. I don't need a gun. Like, I can kill you with a fire extinguisher. You know, your brain's the weapon. Anyway, so I was teaching that school. And then they asked me if I would create an FBI-centric close protection school, which I did. So that was cool. During that overseas survival school, we were giving out a book called The Gift of Fear, written by a guy named Gavin DeBecker. I didn't know anything about Gavin DeBecker other than this great book. And I thought he was an author. I had no idea he owned a protection company, like nothing. I was creating the protection school, and I used another one of his books called Just 2 Seconds. And I got a call or an email from him saying, hey, are you using my material at the FBI Academy? And of course, I didn't ask for permission. I just did it. I just kind of, I don't know. I used common sense. I just wanted to get it done. So I said, yes, sir, I am. And he was all excited and happy and embraced me fully. Anyway, long story short, in 2015, he said, hey, would you like to come to work with me full time? And I left the FBI early, short of retirement. Big, huge commitment right there. Like literally Johnny Utah. I said that earlier. Johnny Utah, right? I threw my badge in the ocean. Like that's what I left. I left early. Walked away, said I'm done, and went to work for Gavin as a director of protection strategies. I did training, audits, operations. I rose to senior vice president of his firm, and I was with him for 9 years. At the end, I was running all ops, all audits, all training, all internal affairs. And then this year, I decided to launch my own company called Hamilton Security Group, which is really dedicated to empowering individuals to protect themselves. I do that through something called the Safety Seminar, which is a really a 90-minute presentation of 32 years of everything I've learned about what works, what doesn't work, how to keep people safe. A little bit, Kara, what you saw at the I Will Survive weekend. And yeah, I got a wife. I've been married since 94. So we'll be hitting our 30 year. This year, we'll hit it 30 years. And I have two children. They're both adults. One's a college graduate and one's in college as a senior right now. So that's kind of me.
So for the people that are listening, what you didn't see is Kim and I literally like breaking out in the full range of emotions from the goosebumps. I literally had goosebumps when you said, I don't know if you've ever been to a police funeral, but it sticks with you. Like I was covered in goosebumps because yeah, they stick with you. I will never forget the first one that I went to and they do that tone out for the badge number. Ooh, I like literally covered in chills right now. They're tough. When did you leave Richland County? What year was it?
97. And, you know, back then, and unfortunately still today, you know, you could be on the road for up to 1 year before they sent you to the academy. It's wild. Part of that whole thing. Yeah, I'll just give them a gun. I mean, I remember my training officer was like, hey, I mean, first day, they just give me a revolver and say, hey, there's your FTO. And I remember we were driving around and he's like, hey, do you know how to shoot? I'm like, kinda. I mean, my father taught me how to shoot a pistol. And we went to like a rock pile off of a Monticello Road or something. And he's like, okay, shoot into that rock pile. Okay. And then he said, basically, if I pull out my gun and start shooting, you do the same thing. That was like my instruction in deadly force. And I was like, this is crazy.
Wow. Well, I will say, I think it's a little different at Richland County now. Good. They generally don't give people guns until after the academy, but yeah. That is so wild. And I mean, you know as well as I do that there's good training mm-hmm. officers, good FTOs, and bad ones. I have told stories here of like the two officers that I had when I was in investigations, and I had a good one and I had a not so good one. So thank you for sharing all of that with us.
Sure.
I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I went and trained at the SIG Academy in New Hampshire for 10 days straight. And I thought that I was proficient with a firearm going into that. And it is you don't know what you don't know. Just the thought when I finished training, they're like, you have more training now than most sworn officers will in their lifetime. I'm like, what? Why? Why? But something that stuck out to me, number one, while you were talking, that Kara and I know are making ginormous eyes at each other. Your brain's the weapon. Holy cow.
Yep.
Because that is what we talk about here all the time. Like you already have all of the tools inside of you that you need. You've got to figure out how to use them. You've got to figure out when you tap into those. I'd love to hear a little bit about your trainings and, you know, who are you working with? What does that look like?
Right. Let's go back real fast. You got great training, by the way. I know those guys at SIG, and even though FBI was a Glock mm-hmm. organization, I've trained with those SIG guys. They're very, very good. Just to show you how little I actually knew, this is a true story. So, Kara, do you remember when you went through the South Carolina Criminal Justice Academy, the winner of the Marksmanship Award, it was called the Clifford A. Moyer Award, right? Mm-hmm. The red badge.
Yeah.
I got that. In my academy, I'm not tooting my own horn here because this is how terrible it is. I won that for my academy class. I got to the FBI. I couldn't hit shit. Excuse my language. I couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. Why? Because when I got there, I had an old revolver grip that my dad taught me. And that's what I was using when I got to Quantico. And they like did the, you know, thumbs forward wrist lock thing. I couldn't shoot to save my life. I couldn't hit anything. I was going to a local gun range in Quantico on the weekends, renting a gun. I was terrified because the FBI does not screw around when it comes to legal and firearms. So they will throw you out of that place. So I was absolutely terrified that I was going to get kicked out because I couldn't shoot. Because I had really bad habits. So that's like what Kim was talking about. Like, you don't know what you don't know. I didn't know anything. Those guys, the people at the FBI Firearms Training Unit are the best in the world. I mean, I've seen a lot. They are the best firearm instructors I've ever seen in my life. They are unbelievable. I will always give those people tremendous kudos. All right. So Kim, back to your question. So what I do, who I work with, it's funny. People ask me, like, I did a whole thing. Like, hey, who's your ideal client? Any human being concerned about their own safety, right? So like, that's everyone, or it should be. I always say, you know, that what's the financial advice? It's like, no one cares about your money more than you do. Well, no one should care about your safety more than you do, right? Like, you should be owning your own safety.
Your client is someone with a heartbeat that would like to keep their heart beating.
Right.
Got it.
Amen. And they can pay the freight. And by the way, my freight is a sliding scale, meaning I don't charge, you know, a Fortune 500 company what I would charge you guys, or, you know, somebody just like, three women want to get together and their bridge group want to have me come in. I might even do it, you know, just to help them for nothing, you know, for very little money. So my scale is like super sliding. But that's who I want to work with, are people that really want to understand, hey, how do I keep myself safe without going through some program or some long school or get some belt through some, you know, sensei or whatever, you know, just give me the greatest hits, James, in 90 minutes. And what I do is, like you were saying, Kim, I first explain to them, you've already got it. Okay. So unfortunately, what's happened is we've subcontracted our own security through the modern experience, meaning we call 911, we're in trouble. That's what we've been taught to do since we were kids. It's on the side of the car, call 911. You subcontracted your own security. Our ancestors did not do that. Okay. 500, 600, 700 years ago, our ancestors did not have the luxury of 911. So they freaking handled their business, or they got the hell beat out of them and they moved on and they started over and they got stronger. That's what's happened, right? So I explained to them, first of all, it's within you. I just got to pull it out of you. Secondly, you just got to get past all the cultural nonsense that makes them deny their intuition. Right? That's what happens. Humans deny intuition. They say, oh, he won't hurt me. Or monsters, you know, look like this. That's my big thing is, you know, we tell our people a monster, if you read the news, it says a monster kill somebody, or a madman, you know, kill three people in a grocery store. Well, they're not monsters or madmen. This isn't a comic book. They're human beings, right? And what happens is people start to think, oh, well, I've been told they're monsters, but my neighbor's holding a gun. Well, that's your neighbor, but he's whatever has happened in his life. And now he's gone to violence because people do that. Violence is currency. And now you need to do something, right? And if the police are too far away, which they usually are, well, you need to freaking handle your stuff. And usually that is get away from it. Get away from this thing now. So I spent a lot of time with mindset. I spend a lot of time, before you even get to situational awareness, I spend a lot of time with self-awareness. Like, what are you really capable of doing? Who is your commitment to? What is your capacity for violence? And then what are the consequences? What are the consequences for using violence? And what are the consequences for not using it and you getting victimized, right? And a lot of people are like, whoa, what do you mean? I'm like, well, just because you have a CWP doesn't mean you can just shoot anyone you want. Do you even understand the law? Because there are consequences, right? And a lot of people I've seen, they start pressing that trigger and they're like, well, I have a CWP. Well, that doesn't mean you're in imminent danger of death or serious bodily injury. So that's the whole thing, right?
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. I'm just thinking as you're talking of so many things, because even myself, having gone through law enforcement training, having the ability and the training and the intuition, I remember thinking my husband left law enforcement, went and did contract work, but he was a canine officer. Good friends with the sheriff, obviously, and the dog was not ready to retire, but I was like, can we please have him? And so we purchased him at a prorated rate, which was, you know, expensive. But my husband was out of the country and I had two little kids. And I remember thinking I felt so much safer with him because even though I had training, I had guns, I had access to all of these things, I knew he wouldn't hesitate if a bad guy came in.
Right.
I don't know what I would do.
Yeah. Well, I talk a lot about dogs and I talk a lot about less lethal and I talk a lot about going to prison. Like, prison scares me, right? I don't know. I mean, and there's, you know, where we're from, you know, Kara, there's going to be a bumper sticker that says, I'd rather be tried by 12 than carried by 6. And it's some like right. nonsense. Well, you know, people right. who say that, they say that. They've never been to jail. Okay. Right. Like,
Right. And also, people are so well-meaning, but people will hear my story or they'll hear other stories and they're like, but what if you would have ran? What if you would have fought? Why don't you stab somebody? I'm like, have you ever stabbed somebody? Have you ever actually shot someone? Do you know what that feels like? Because if you haven't, you don't know if you can. You don't know what you're going to be able to do in those moments of stress. Right. And so that's one of the things that I love about your information is it's a precursor to that. It's right. Like, what can we do before we get to that moment where the extremely stressful thing kicks in and our body takes over, right? Like, you can't control your reaction.
Right. So much of it's avoidable. Okay, so here's what happens. So I call it the American way. I'm writing a book and there's a whole chapter about it. It's called the American way, right? And in our country, rightly or wrongly, what happens is we think if we insert a gun in the environment, it'll make it safer. And if you don't believe that statement, I would just give you Parkland as an example. After Parkland High School shooting, the very first thing they wanted to do was arm the teachers. That's the very first response, right? Because they believe erroneously, if we insert a gun in the environment, it'll be safer. Well, there was a gun there. There was a gun there and a deputy. He didn't do anything. We know that for a fact, okay? So don't get me started. I know for a fact that a gun in a certain environment may not make it safer. It sure as hell may not. All right, so that's one. Second, there are great examples of where, you know, using a gun makes a lot of sense. Like in your home, you can't escape, your kids are there. Okay, I get it. But if you're in your car and you see some crazy stuff happening that has nothing to do with you, right? I can't tell you how many instructors out there are teaching A-pillar shooting, get after it. What are you, crazy? That's not having to do with you. Drive away. What are you, nuts?
Right.
Right. But they just want to get it on. So if you just train with the tool all the time, well, you're going to use that thing. It's the nail concept, right? If all you got's a hammer, the whole freaking world starts to look like a nail. And you just want to use that thing, man. You just want to get it out. So I'm not saying I never carry. I'm saying this. I carry sparingly. I like to carry a taser a lot. I like less lethal. I don't like prison. I don't know what a prosecutor is going to do. Okay. I am seeing prosecutors indicting police officers. I'm seeing it. I'm seeing prosecutors indicting civilians who use force. I'm seeing it. I don't want to be a test case. So I do everything in my power to avoid it. I do everything in my power to have some tool, like keep myself in shape, first of all, so I can respond effectively, then have a less lethal. But I do carry in some certain circumstances when I know, like, you better have something there, bud. But I don't want to make it, that's all I got. Because then you're one-dimensional. And if you're one-dimensional, when that thing's taken away from you, you're screwed. And I've got a great story about that, if you all have time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I was really into firearms big time. And so the FBI recruits from the SWAT program for their protection teams. So I came from the SWAT program. SWAT is Special Weapons and Tactics. It's all about guns. So I got to the director's detail, and we were carrying a Springfield Armory 1911, $2,000 guns, or probably more at the government rate. My serial number was CRG34. I'll never forget it. I love that thing, right? And so I go to London after the July 7th terrorist bombing in 05. I'm sitting down with my British counterparts, and I asked for, weapons permits for my team. They came back and said, denied. I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, we don't give guns to Americans. We don't give permits out. And we certainly aren't going to give them to the FBI director's detail because we don't even give them to the Secret Service. And I'm like, you're out of your mind. I think I said something really smart. Like, your tie must be choking off your circulation or something because, we're not coming without guns. So I'm literally having a pity party here. Okay. Like, I'm pissed. And I call the FBI. I call headquarters. And I'm like, look, they're not giving us guns. I say we cancel the trip. And I don't have any authority, by the way. I mean, none. And they said, what? They're like, he's coming. Figure it out. I'm like, but we don't have guns. What are we supposed to do? They're like, James, figure it out. Like, quit being a child. They didn't say that. But that's, looking back on it, I was acting like a complete child. So what had happened is I had become one-dimensional. Okay. I had really bought into this firearm thing. I had let myself go physically. I had really believed that, like, I would shoot my way out of it. And then when I read that Gavin DeBecker book, Just 2 Seconds, I learned that no assassination has ever been prevented by the preemptive use of a firearm, ever. Okay. And like in the history of ever. Okay. So that's kind of important to know in that work. But I always thought you had to have a gun to be a bodyguard. Well, that's total nonsense. You really have to understand distance and time and positioning and cover and evac and all those like preventive type things, but that I know now. But this was a long time ago. This was like 04, 05. But I really had a pity party and act like a child because I couldn't get my little gun. And now I know, like, that's the last thing I really needed. I needed a bunch of phones and a bunch of communication, a bunch of logistics, armored cars. Like, those are the things that I really needed to concentrate on. So I say that to say that I have been part of pushing that American way methodology also. And I, you know, I've grown up and I know that, you know, that's not the end all be all tool. The brain's the weapon and everything else in your hand is just an implement to that.
I remember when I met you and I heard you speak, one of the things that stuck with me that I want to expand upon is you said to this group of women, you said, you're going to get self-defense training and you're going to get CWP training. You're going to get firearms training, but my goal is for you to never have to use that.
Yeah.
You said, basically, if we have to use those tools that you have failed in teaching us. So I would love to hear you talk more about this idea of the brain is the weapon and what that means, that your goal is that we don't have to use self-defense, that we don't have to use a weapon. How do we counteract that American way?
All right. So the very first thing, and some people are really good at this and some people are really not good at this. Okay. But the thing I want people to understand is that your body has senses that keep you safe, period. You've had them since the species became the top of the heap. That's vision, that's hearing, that's taste, that's smell, that's touch. Some of us have better awareness than others. Why? Well, if you've been through some type of trauma, like when I heard the sound of the key hitting the door as a kid, I knew what that meant. All right. And so if you had to use your senses, that's why I'm a freak about noises to this day. Okay. So there's a double-edged sword here. People with really good situational awareness also can lose their stuff on the back end and, you know, like act like an idiot sometimes, like in their family, like I do this with my family. Right. And so I'm a freak about noises. Why? Well, because my hearing kept me safe when I was a kid. Well, now as an adult, when I hear a sound, everything stops for me. Right? Like I'm fully present. I'm fully there. And so back to your question, Kara, like I don't let people get behind me, right? Like I don't care if I'm in church or grocery store or McDonald's. I don't care. I'm in tune with my senses and the environment. That's what situational awareness is your awareness of that environment. Okay. It's not disrupted by the phone, the earbuds, alcohol, things that can diminish your awareness. I don't do any of that stuff. Right. And I don't let people get behind me. So the idea that you're going to somehow, you know, get me in a situation where I'm going to have to produce a gun and save my own life is pretty rare. I can pretty much avoid most things if I'm paying attention. And that's what I want for people to do is understand where they are and put everything away. Right. So a good example, like one of the things I talk about in the safety seminar, Kim, is, you know, attacks don't just happen. Okay. So if you're being targeted individually, these things don't just happen. They happen in a location dependent environment. What is that? A choke point, an area of mandatory travel, an area where I know you're going to be, or the offender, your ex-boyfriend, your ex-husband, the stalker from work. He knows you're going to be at your car. He knows you're going to be going to your driveway. So in those areas, like I really tell people, you know, I use Cooper's color code and you're in orange in those areas. Like you're like, everything stops. It's an all stop. You put your phone down, you turn the car off, you look around, you pay attention, you shine the area with a flashlight, whatever you got to do before you get out of that car. You don't just walk into things without being fully aware. That's the point. And so much of this can be prevented if people would do that, right? So much. Now, some of it can't. I know that it happens. But by and large, I mean, this is what I do for a living. I study this stuff and I understand the stuff and I preach, you know, prevention. Most of the examples I'm aware of, they could have been prevented if we had just paid attention or we were judgmental. And a lot of times I'll hear people say, oh, I don't want to be judgmental. You are judgmental. Okay, stop it. So when people go, oh, I don't want to feel that way about the mailman. Okay, well, you are. So stop it. You know, like I wish the world wasn't the way it is. I wish my job didn't exist. I really do. But that's just a wish. It just is. I wish people didn't hurt people, but they do, right? Like that's the reality. I always talk about start with reality, right? And the reality is this is what happens, right? There's no way to kind of get around that one. And there's reasons why these things happen, but start with that reality. Understand, okay, it can happen. Not that it will, but it can. And then these are some practical steps to take to, you know, keep yourself safe. I preach a message of preparedness, not paranoia, right? That doesn't help you. It doesn't help you just rolling around in red with your knife, your keys, ready to strike, like paranoid maniac, like relax. But in some areas, turn up that intensity of awareness, right?
Yeah. What I'm hearing you say is that you get to choose. Your trauma can be a training or it can be the source of your paranoia. And you have to choose how you do this. How do you go forward? I want to talk a little bit in the broad scope of things, because this is very clearly a prevention conversation. We have a lot of people who either have already been victimized, or, you know, it may happen to. When you do this kind of work, especially with women, how do you make this conversation not about victim blaming, but instead about prevention and keeping that situational awareness without them taking on that shame and guilt of maybe what has already happened to them?
Yeah. There's two answers to that question. One is whatever you did in the moment must have worked because you're alive. Because at the end of the day, that's the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to be alive, period. So, you know, people think, okay, what's the mission, right? I talk about like in a Chick-fil-A line and some guy pulls out a gun. Okay, the mission is not getting Chick-fil-A. The mission is get home alive, right? And that's what people do is they get so caught up in their, they think the mission is going to the kids' recital or seeing the concert or getting Chick-fil-A. It's not. It's always survival, always, first. Second, is women have better intuition than men. That's just a fact, okay? I do this for a living and I ask that question. I ask crowds of people, thousands of people I've talked to, who has better intuition, men or women? And they say women. No one has ever said men, ever, ever, by the way. And to steal from Gavin, you know, why is that? Well, because women live a different life than a man. If you ask that same group of people, when was the last time you were scared to death? The men would really have to think about that question. But the women would be like, you know, last night, last week, last date I was on, you know, this afternoon walking through the parking lot of Target, you know, like, why? Well, because though not politically correct, it is statistically accurate that women are sexually assaulted more than men, period. That's just a fact. Okay. And so it's naive to think or to say that a woman shouldn't like listen to her intuition. Okay. That's just completely ridiculous. They have better intuition. Why? Because they are victimized more than men. So, and I always say this too. First of all, I get really irritated because, you know, a lot of people in my space are male and they'll think, oh, you know, and I tell women this, there's a video I did about it about, you know, I'm sorry if a man in your life has ever said you're paranoid. Okay. Or you're too emotional. I'm sorry, because that guy has no freaking idea what he's talking about. None. Okay. Because he has never lived your life. He has never known what it's like to walk through a parking lot with, you know, two kids and a stroller, right? And you're thinking about putting the groceries away and this creep's over here looking at you. A man has never been worried about that, but you might be, right? Why? Because it's a thing. So that's my first thing is I'm sorry. Second is be empowered and be powerful and understand your intuition is right. It is always right. It always right because it's about you. Your dogs don't have intuition. We can talk about that when you want, but dogs don't have intuition. Dogs are picking up on your uncomfortable ability in that situation. Okay. Right, Kara? Preach it. So that's like one thing I tell women specifically is listen to that and don't be worried about being rude. Okay. Unfortunately, our culture is like, oh, don't be rude. Don't be rude. Don't be rude. Well, okay. I would rather you be rude than be a victim. Okay. Period. Right. So here's a good example. And I walk through people through this in the safety seminar, Kim. It's like, okay, we're at a Target and you're pushing your cart, you know, to the car. And there's a guy and I got a picture of a guy and he walks over and says, hey, can I help you? And for whatever reason, your intuition is like, man, this guy's kind of giving me the vibe. You say no. All right. That's a complete sentence. When you say no, that's it. And I don't know you, Kim, but if I walked up to you and said, hey, can I help you with your groceries? And you said, no, thank you. I would say, I'm sorry. And I would walk my ass away. All right. If I'm a predator, I'm going to convince you. I'm going to stay. I'm going to not hear your word. Okay. I will not respect your boundary. And the women listening have got to understand what I'm saying right now. When you say no, or when you say stop, and I do this in the safety seminar, that's it. You've created a boundary. Now, when that person trespasses into that boundary, you got to go to DEFCON 10 now. Hey, this son of a bitch isn't listening. I got to change the game here. Don't say it again. Don't be like the police officer. Say, oh, I'll tell you again. I'm going to tell you again. Okay. And they keep telling them. That police officer doesn't really want to do what they're supposed to be doing. All right. When they don't respect your boundary, they will hurt you. They will hurt you. Right. So that's the first clue. Your intuition is like, hey, I told that guy no. And now he's trying to convince me. And they're like, no, MF-er, you're not hearing me. Right. And remember, this isn't about the grocery cart at this point. This has changed. Okay. It's not about getting my kids to the car in Target parking lot. Now I got to deal with this thing right here. And that's usually extraction. Let's go back inside, right? Back inside. I talk a lot to mothers about getting your kids in the car, play a game, not in the Target parking lot, but in your driveway. Just say, hey, who can get in the car the fastest and buckle up? I'll give you a sucker. And just get them to doing that and give them a code word like avalanche or landslide or something and say, hey, when I say landslide, let's get in the car as fast as we possibly can. And whoever wins, you know, gets Chick-fil-A or whatever. Because when you need that, it's going to be very, very effective. for a parent, two things. Don't be that parent. Go, oh, I don't want to be like that with my kids. I don't want my kids to ever think something bad could happen. Okay, don't do that because bad shit does happen, period. Second, don't tell your kids, hey, we're doing landslide in case some creek comes up and he wants to hurt us. Like, don't overtell. Okay. Does that help?
Yeah. Yes. I love it so much because so often I know I get these questions. I'm sure Kim gets them a ton. People will hear our stories. They'll listen to a lot of true crime and they will want advice on how do we keep ourselves safe. And I love like the real tips because it's so important and they're kind of simple. Like I hate to say simple, but it really is kind of simple. And I just think there's so much gold.
I'm just thinking through that we as women will go to such great lengths to not be rude that if we use even an ounce, a fraction of that energy to just listen to our intuition instead, we'd be golden. The thing that I think about on a broader context is that women who are rude, women who do just say no, are labeled as problems. They're labeled as problems to the people who want to harm, want to take advantage, want the status quo to make them more susceptible to being victims. Those are the people that have problems with feminism in general, or just the fact that you feel empowered enough to be on that same playing field as somebody else. And I love that you said that no was a complete sentence. We say that all the time here. Yes, I just, every single thing that you were hitting on is a 35,000 foot view of something that you could expand upon in massive ways because each and every one of those is such a valuable topic. Just kudos. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. The one thing I got in the safety seminar that I'll do is I'll do a kind of a ask for a volunteer. And then, I tell the volunteer, hey, raise your hand when you're uncomfortable. And I'll start walking towards them. When that hand comes up, I stop. I make sure the audience understands, okay, that's the boundary. The boundary has begun, right? That hand, that's a universal sign for stop. No matter where you are, travel, it doesn't matter. This means stop. If I kept coming, that's a communication. My hand's in my pocket is a communication. Right. Mm-hmm. I always talk about the things like I always have with me, like a cup of coffee. And a lot of people don't pick up on it, but I don't have a lid on the top of my coffee. And the reason I don't have the lid is because I'm going to throw it in your face. And by throwing it in your face, it's going to give me that thing I need, which is time. Time to take your legs out. Time to run away. Time to kick you in the gonad. It's going to buy me some time. And I learned that from my father. My father talked a lot about distraction, right? Flashlight. I carry a flashlight everywhere I go. Why? Because I'm going to shine it in your eye. I'm going to take your eyes away. So hairspray, coffee, light. I talked in the safety seminar about predator or about humans and where they're weak. And all humans are weak in the eyes, right? I don't care if you're Jason Bourne, super assassin. If I take your eyes away, which by the way, I'm going to do, you cannot hurt me because you can't see me, right? And I think a lot of people miss that. And that's why I like hairspray. That's why I like spray of any kind. That's why I like a fire extinguisher. That's why I like coffee. I like a hot, hot liquid going into your face. And so those are all things that I am a real big fan of. And this other thing I talk a lot about, which is, okay, if all you've got, your one-dimensional firearm, firearm, okay, and you're at 40,000 feet, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. You ain't going to do nothing, right? I will. I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to have coffee and I'm going to know where the fire extinguisher is. And I'm in shape, by the way, and I can fight, right? That's the other thing is, we tell our citizens, run, hide, fight. Well, how many people can really run? Mm-hmm. Really? And how many people can actually fight? I mean, that's the best we can do. I mean, I don't want to get going. That's the whole thing. So that's a big part of it too. When I talk about self-awareness is, capability. Are you in shape? Can you handle it? Commitment? Are you with your kids? I mean, like all these things matter because that forms the decision-making, right? And people haven't thought about these things. Like, what would I do? Well, you got to first think about it and think about it in the safe confines of your home until you're forced into that situation. Like, would you get in a trunk? That's the thing. Would you get in a trunk? Right? I ask my audiences that question. Would you get into a trunk? That's like popping the cork on a bottle of wine. Let that one just sit there for a minute.
Yeah.
All right? Like, I wouldn't. I'm not getting in a trunk. I tell you right now. Why? Because I know just from my experience what happens. You go to a secondary crime scene. May not survive it, right? It's really hard to put someone in a trunk, by the way. It really is, especially if they don't want to go.
Or a ready-made container.
Or, okay. So, I have chill bumps because this is proof that our bodies keep us alive. Like if you're in any way, shape, or form questioning this idea of our intuition and our bodies keeping us alive, I did that automatically. I didn't see the gun. I didn't know it was there until I felt it. And I immediately started formulating a plan. Feigned compliance. That's exactly. I was like, I'm just going to go along with what he says so that he thinks that I am complacent. Yeah. And then when his guard is down, because I thought about fighting him, I thought about stabbing him at various times. I was like, I'm little, he's big. My best chance is going to be when he's asleep. And so that was the plan. And yeah, I went for it with everything. So I'm so glad that you said that. I mean, like I said, not that I needed the confirmation, but people inevitably will armchair quarterback every situation they hear. Why didn't you fight? Why didn't you run? Don't ever be taken to a secondary location. I'm like,
oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Like, yeah. Well, I'm 15-year-old Kara. And 20-year-old Kim, yep, were formulating plans and doing the things that you are talking about without the verbiage that you are offering here. We were doing appease. And even though, like, we may have had moments where we were frozen, or we may have had these moments where we're thinking through things, we didn't know that that's situational awareness or listening to our intuition or forming a plan, but we did it anyway. And so many people do the same thing and then are hit with that shame or guilt because... same thing. Well, why didn't, yeah, I do that? Why didn't I run, fight, kick, scream? Because it would have probably got you more harm, got you more harmed. Words.
Right. And what happens, you know, your body is amazing. What happens is it breaks it down into minor seconds, like fractions of seconds. And what happens is you're saying to yourself, I'm not dead. I'm not dying. So whatever I'm doing right now is working. Keep doing it. Right. That's what your body does. Your body will shut down and it will literally just say, just keep doing whatever you're doing to survive. Right. And yeah, you'll put up with a hell of a lot that you all both put up with, but you lived. Right. And so I think never give in to the critics ever, because they weren't there and they don't know. That's why, like, the quote behind me is the Teddy Roosevelt. It's not the critic that counts.
Oh, samesies. That's what that one is right there. Wait, what is it? I don't.
He says, it's not the critics that counts. It's not the man that points out how the strong man stumbled or the doers of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who was actually in the arena. And my favorite part of the quote is that, you know, his place will never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. Meaning, you know, at least he put it out there.
Brené Brown talks about this and takes it a step further and says that if you are not in the arena also getting your ass kicked, I am not interested in your feedback.
Yeah, I love that.
You need this quote. It is like a driving, yeah, force, yeah, behind so much. So I said I wanted to circle back to this because when you were talking about taking out a sense, especially eyesight, I was woke without a sense of sight. And so I had to heavily rely on all sounds and still, well, before fit therapy, could have been big triggers for me. But it is something now that I know I can be reliant upon and still gather as much information as I can. My brain was going through that assessment of, am I alone? Do I have full capability to move? Which I didn't. What do I have around me that I could defend myself with? Many things. However, even if I got to them, they could have been turned and used against me. When I did a lot in firearms work and self-protection stuff, that was constantly the quote that I kept hearing, or the comment. If you would have had a gun, would you have used it? I don't know. I don't know. And I have one now that when I choose to carry, the big thing that rings in my head with SIG is the goal is to just get out. It's there. You know that that tool is there. It's not to let anyone know. And I think that that can be said of a lot of the things that you're talking about. All of this intuition, the things that are in your mind, it's not as if I'm going to that go-to. You know, if you're on an airplane, 40,000 feet, you're not just going to use that one thing. We are talking about a whole broad spectrum of things that you can engage. The part that I come back to, though, is that I had that experience, and so many people have the experience where their boundaries are pushed little by little, and then they get to a place over days, months, years, where they don't realize that they're in trouble. How do you talk to those victims, especially women, on how to disengage safely from those situations?
Well, I'll tell you, it's very difficult. There's a couple of reasons. One is that the unknown is scarier than the known. What you find a lot of times is that the person could be in danger, but they don't feel like it's imminent. He hasn't killed me yet. Right. I can't tell you, Kara can testify to this, how many, you know, domestics you go to, and this has been going on for years, and he's beat her and all these things, but she won't leave. And the reason is, a lot of times, it's not that she loves him, it's that there's security and safety, and it's scary to go out into the unknown. Right. And so that's a huge threshold to get over, first of all. And then the second thing I find, at least in my work, is that there's so much bad information, okay? You know, a police officer might say, well, just get a restraining order. But then they talk to me and I'm like, well, the first goal of threat assessment is that this person is not obsessed with you anymore and we want them to detach and move away. Well, the restraining order is the last thing I would ever say to get because that means court. That means I'm going to be seeing him. That means, you know, false sense of security. I always talk about, do you want safety or justice? And you know, which one do you want? Because they're not the same. All right. They're not the same, right? You're not going to get both. I'm sorry. Okay. So which one do you want? And then they look at me and, you know, they'll say, I want both. I'm like, you can't have both. Pick one. If they say safety, they're like, okay, you might need to move. You might need to drop Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, TikTok, whatever I'm missing, X. I don't give a damn. Get rid of your phone altogether, but let's get away from this guy. Right. Because a lot of times in a threat assessment, you know, what we're trying to do is get the person to disengage. And unfortunately, a lot of the things that the Justice Department or the justice system wants to give you, protective orders, restraining orders, those types of things, those are all about engagement. Those aren't disengagement. And so that's one of the things I struggle with, Kim, is I give advice, and this just happened to me. I was given advice and somebody from an agency, a police officer, was giving this victim contradictory advice. And I lost track of them and they called me about a month ago and said, oh, I'm getting a restraining order. I'm like, well, I didn't tell you to do that. And I think that's not a good idea. But yeah, so that's part of it is getting the people who really do want to get out of the situation and then giving them the good guidance to get out of it. So make them choose safety over justice. Because I just don't think the justice system will actually give you justice in the end. It might be temporary, but I don't think it'll be full.
Well, it's like you have to understand also, if you're listening to this, what we know is that it's kind of hard to prove someone guilty of things very often.
And getting harder.
Yeah. Like we all understand that because our justice system functions on innocent until proven guilty. So the burden of proof is on the person that was hurt often, which is frustrating. However, I know that if my sons were accused of hurting someone, I would want them to be innocent until proven guilty, right? If you as a person were accused of something that you did not do, or even if you did, I don't know your business, you would want to be innocent until proven guilty, right? It's frustrating. And I love that you said safety. I come back continuously to this idea that I've heard somewhat recently, and I will repeat often. And it's like, your safety is not someone else's concern. Right. Like your safety is your business. And it goes back to you saying we're outsourcing it. And I see, you know, I'm on the line. I'm on all of the lines. So I see all of these videos about personal safety. And even I, having had training, took away from the I Will Survive weekend, I didn't even leave. And I was on Amazon buying a tactical flashlight. I was on there buying, I have like a little safety tool. It has like a glass breaker. It has like all these things that I can carry when I go on an airplane. I can take it anywhere, but it's got a pokey end, right? And so it's like, I took things from that. Now I also do have pepper spray. I carry that, you know, I bought Saber Red because I'm like, I know that shit hurts. Like I've been sprayed with Saber Red. I know what that feels like. So I have those things as well. But one of the things I often tell people, because again, they want those tools. They want those things. I said, you're relying on your ability to use those things in that moment also. Yep. So again, those things often become a crutch. So I love the empowerment that comes from teaching people how to use their systems that we all have. Kim and I tell people all the time, there's nothing special inside of me that made me survive that's not inside of every single person listening to this. We are all created to survive. We all have intuition. We can all keep ourselves a little bit safer. And situational awareness or lack of situational awareness, it's an epidemic in this country.
It is. Well, these things are designed to do that.
He's holding up a phone, by the way.
The people who design apps, they're trying to get your attention, right? They want your brain here all the time. That's what they're being paid to do. And, you know, dopamine is a real response, right? It's a real thing. And so you're wanting to check that thing incessantly. And then you put these guys in and you're looking down and they're happy, but it's terrible for a safety situation. It's just ridiculously awful. There was something you said I wanted to kind of go back to if we could. And that was
that your safety is your own business.
Yeah. I think people have to be told that it's okay to fight for themselves. I think that a lot of people live with some shame or some feeling as though they're not enough or they're not worthy or they deserve this or something. And I think it's always important for your listeners to know, and I'm talking to every single one of them right now, you know, that you are enough and that you're worth fighting for. you know, and the people in your life should do that. And if they don't, get rid of them. Gavin has a great thing about, you know, he says, make very slow choices about the people you let into your life, and you make fast decisions about those you exclude, the people you get out. And he's right. And unfortunately, I think we do it the opposite. We get in bed real quick with somebody, and then we take forever to break up with them. Or we hire somebody real quick, and we take forever to fire them. And it really should be the other way around. Really, really slow, methodical, like, who is this person, and should I let them into my world?
So I have a quick story that I want to share. So when Kara first told me that she had met you and the things that you were talking about, and it reminded me of something that I had completely forgotten about. And when I came forward with my story after trial, I got justice. I don't know about safety. There's safety until he gets out on parole, which he's going through that process now. But I got a call from someone on our landline at home, and my mom's looking at it and says, Harpo Productions. We're like, the heck is that? And she answers, and they're looking for me. There was a producer who had called and reached out because I had just come forward with my story, which really didn't happen that often back in 2007. And this producer is talking to me because they are going to have someone on the Oprah show. And his name's Gavin DeBecker. And they are looking for real stories about women who would tie into this book that he's coming out with. And it's called The Gift of Fear. And I was like, oh, I haven't read that. Tell me what it's about. And it's listening to your intuition. And they wanted to highlight if there was the ability for me to have disengaged or to know that I was being stalked. And I had to sit on that because here I am at 21 years old, just having come forward, wanting to help anybody who would listen. And here's an opportunity to go meet Oprah and talk about these things. And I had to call him back and say, I can't, because I didn't have any intuition. And I've sat with that for so many years. And it's not a victim blaming place. I know the one person that is responsible for what happened to me was the person who chose to commit that crime. And he is sitting in prison right now. However, I'm thinking maybe there was something. And I have loved hearing you talk about these things with situational awareness and how it is not victim blaming. Because at no point have you said, don't go on and live your life. Don't go out and not have fun. It's be aware of these things. Because what I didn't know at the time is that this guy had seen me and my friends at a bar and tried dancing with us. And he followed us home because we said no. I had no idea that that's where that started and that we were stalked for a week. I also can go back in Monday morning quarterback and say, if I had had the information that I have now, maybe I would have closed my blinds a little bit more. Maybe I would make sure that I'm going to lock my door. Maybe I'm going to make sure that those locks are working. I'm going to follow up with maintenance because this lock is broken, and I'm going to demand that my safety is important to them. It's not as if I'm thinking I shouldn't have been living my life. It's that I'm going to take my safety seriously. And it doesn't mean that somebody isn't going to break through my window and victimize me. It does mean that I'm going to make it a lot harder for that to happen. And in no way, shape, or form am I going to feel guilt over putting my safety first. So I had to say, nope, I don't think that this aligns for me. And I have thought about that ever since then. So it's been really nice to hear you talk about these things because I didn't see the connection then. And today I do.
Good. Thank you, by the way, for sharing all that. Mm-hmm. One of the things I talk about is that people are only really targeted three ways. Okay. There's random, like completely wrong place, wrong time. Then there's group association, people who are targeted because of their Christian or their religion, sexual orientation, sex. Even Americans have been targeted because they're Americans. And then lastly, there's people who are targeted by name. So by name, someone is coming after you individually. And what I always tell my audience is if you are being targeted by name, meaning someone wants to hurt you because they don't like you, something's going on, you need professional guidance. You need someone who really understands this world to help you tighten up in these spaces, right? So your home, transition points, you know, that's surveillance, spotting surveillance, those types of things you were talking about, Kim. Those are the things I do in my work is I help people who are being individually targeted. Because unfortunately, what we do is we just call the police. And here's what happens. The police will say something, right? And it could be complete wingnut stuff. And because they are of authority, the person hears it and thinks, oh, it must be right because a police officer told me. And most police officers are not trained in threat assessment. There's no, and I can just speak from the FBI Academy. There is no training in the FBI Academy in threat assessment for new agents. None, right? And so, but people think, oh, because a police officer told me to get a restraining order, I'm going to get a restraining order. That's probably the worst thing to get, right? At least talk to a professional who does this for a living, you know? So I tell you all that, Kim, so that when it's getting close, if he gets out, call me and I'm going to give you some tips.
Absolutely.
And I think it's important to remember too, just to piggyback on what you said, that law enforcement, they're bound by the confines mm-hmm. of the law. And I know here in South Carolina, to get a restraining order, there have to be multiple offenses of someone breaching your boundary before you could even be considered for a restraining order. So it's like, do you want justice or do you want safety? Because if you're relying on justice and you're relying on a restraining order, your safety has to be challenged multiple times before you get to that point. So I just want to like reinforce that real hard and fast, because 100%. Oh, so much good information. My goodness. I am just so glad we had this conversation. I have been looking forward to it. And I'm sure that there will be some follow-up questions, and hopefully we can get you back on and answer some of those questions, because I just know people are going to want to just really dive into this so much. I want to end this with your call to action. We always like to really motivate people and activate our followers with a good call to action. So what would you like to encourage people to go and do?
Live with courage. That is my mantra. That is what I believe in. That's what I tell everybody that follows me, is live with courage. And for this specific audience that we're talking to, it's the courage to be rude, the courage to say no, the courage to fight for yourself, the courage, you know, to call BS when they see it. They're smart. Everyone listening to this podcast is a smart person. So when someone's pontificating bullshit, excuse my language, just have the courage to call it out and go, you know what? I think that sounds dumb.
Yes.
And and move on, right? Because there's a lot of bad information out there, right? Don't get, you know, kind of caught up in that. I think that there's some people giving out some good information, and listen to them. So that would be it for me, Kara and Kim. You know, live with courage in your life, because it's not easy. A lot of people don't. It's hard.
Tell our listeners where they can find out more about you. Can they follow you somewhere legally and with consent?
Yes, they can. I would say, please get in touch with me. Please follow me. My website is hamiltonsecuritygroup.com. I'm on LinkedIn. Please reach out. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Pinterest. Oh, yeah, I've got a YouTube channel called Safety Seconds with James. So these are quick little vignettes of things that I do to just keep myself safe. Please follow me. But most importantly, just reach out. If you've got a question or you want to have me come talk to you or your group, it is summer. If you want to, you know, do something about girls going back to college, I'm happy to do that. That's a big one for me, because I do have a daughter who just got out of college and I'm still terrified for her. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's where you can find me. And if you call me, I will call you back. I believe in ridiculous responsiveness, and I won't waste your time. I promise you that, because I know how valuable it is.
Excellent. Well, and we will be sure to put all of those in show notes. You'll be able to, if you're following us on anything, we're going to make sure to tag. I want to thank you immensely for your time today and sharing your knowledge. This has been an incredible conversation, and I really know, I mean, I got a lot out of it. I know Kara has multiple times, and I'm really excited to introduce you to our listeners here.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm proud of both of y'all. I know you probably hear that a lot, but I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you that you survived and you're doing something with it. You're doing something good with it, and you're going to make a difference for people. And that's what, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about, right? That we made a difference. I always talk about, how do you define your dash? You know, like when you die, it'll say like your birth date and your death date, and there's a dash between it, right? So like, how do you define it? I don't want to be some tree falling in the forest and no one knew. You know, you want to make sure that you left your mark. And I think you both are doing that. So I thank you both very much for the important work you're doing.
Thank you.
I know.
Feelings.
Thank you. Oh, why do people have to make us feel things? Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain. If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show. To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com. Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.
Why the fuck am I so awkward?
Like charcuterie board.